All right, so welcome to the audio version of Obesity Panacea. This is episode number 11, as well as episode 2 of what I'm calling Cybling Showdown, until I get a better name. So here on this podcast, we've got three other science bloggers. So why doesn't everyone introduce themselves? Jason, you want to start?
Sure. I'm Jason. I blog for The Thoughtful Animal. I'm a grad, just starting my fourth year as a grad student in Los Angeles.
And Sycurious?
Hello, I am Sycurious. I blog at Neurotopia, and I have escaped from the horrible hell that is grad school. I am a postdoc, haha. But I still remember very vividly what grad school was like.
Is postdocness very different from being a grad student? I kind of thought it was just a continuation of the same thing.
There's less starvation involved.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and Christy.
Oh, yeah. Hi, I'm Christy, and I blog over at Observations of a Nerd, and I am currently about to start, I guess, my second year of my doctoral dissertation at the University of Hawaii.
Cool. And I think we're crossing about 8 time zones here, so this is very exciting. And 2 countries. So why don't we start off then with things to kind of look for or look out for when choosing a lab. So I should say the thing we're going to be talking about today on the podcast is grad school experience. So sort of no real strict format here, but just things in general about grad school, good and bad. So I guess, Sycurious, do you want to get us started then on some things that you think people should look for or look out for when choosing a lab?
Well, okay. I mean, first off, the stuff you want to look for, I mean, this is all stuff I wish I knew. I ended up choosing a great lab, but it was entirely by accident. So things that I wish I knew, I guess, there's having a cool advisor and there's having a good advisor, and you need to know the difference. An advisor that takes you out for beers may not be the one that gets your manuscript out on time. And you're really lucky if those two coincide, but an advisor in a lab where you have a good time may not necessarily be the best one to do your work in. Though if it was, it'd be awesome.
So it's kind of like, you know, you want a parent, not a friend kind of thing. It's sort of the same thing with choosing a supervisor, you feel?
I think so. I mean, there are some people who are more independent researchers than others, but you do want to have an advisor who will draw that line with you. You know, you don't want them telling you about their love lives and stuff. So it's often hysterically sordid. And then well worth hearing if you can get them drunk enough. But anyway, you do don't want them knowing that.
Well, how did you guys go about choosing your labs? Like, I know here, before I did my master's or my PhD, I went, kind of met the lab, met a few of the grad students, talked with the professor, and that was about it. You know, it was a sort of a day or a half day of meeting people, and then you make this huge decision. Was it kind of the same for you guys?
For me, it was very different, but that's only because I'm lucky. And the program I chose at the University of Hawaii actually has a year of rotations. And so what you have to do is you have to work in 3 different labs for 13 weeks each. And that's your required. And you can't choose anybody until you're done with that. And so in my case, I ended up, the lab I'm ending up in was my second rotation. And after spending time in it and working with the people and with my advisor, I mean, I knew this was the place I wanted to be. But I thought, I mean, I don't know if other people, if how many programs offer that, but if you get that opportunity, it's really worth it.
Does that get kind of, like, competitive? Like, if, you know, if there's one lab that everyone wants to get with, does it get kind of cutthroat in that first year, everyone trying to, like, you know, get cozy with that person?
The thing is, yes and no. In my case, I'm unique. I'm in a cell and molecular biology program full of medical-oriented grad students, so I'm the only one who cares about fish and ecology.
Oh.
So nobody was competing with me, and nobody cared where I ended up. But the other students, I mean, yeah, there was definitely some cutthroat going on between them and each other and who wants to, you know, get with which professor and getting in the labs that they want and getting the funding that they want.
Right. And Jason, how do you go about choosing where you're doing your PhD?
Well, my story is a little bit different. I actually started in the lab that I'm still in now when I was an undergrad. I knew I wanted to get involved in research. I wanted to do something related to imaging and, you know, cognitive neuroscience. And I just sort of started joining this lab, and it turned out that not only was I interested in the methods, you know, learning about imaging in the brain, but I was actually also interested in the topic of the research, which was reading and dyslexia. But so I just sort of transitioned, you know, from an undergrad RA in the lab to being a grad student in the lab, which obviously could only ever be the case if you become a grad student at the same institution where you're an undergrad. But what's been really important for me is that my advisor is someone who encouraged and supported my sort of changing interests. And as I've found other kinds of research that I've wanted to be involved with, he's been totally on board with me exploring those things, which I think is really important to have an advisor who is not only willing but eager to have you explore your interests as they change.
Well, so have you done? Will that be all 3 degrees then at one institution, or 2 degrees?
Yeah, so I got my master's last December. But yes, it will be 3 degrees when I'm done.
And what about you, other ladies? Did you move around? Like I'm at my third school right now. And I know some people, you know, do 2 or 3. And did you ladies move around or stay or and why? I guess for either.
You
go ahead, Zai.
Okay. Well, I know for me, I moved to my PhD, but in the biomedical program that I went to, it was very much, if you got a master's, that was the consolation prize on your way out the door.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah. though people did voluntarily leave with a master's, you got your master's on the way to a PhD. So I don't have a master's, I just have a PhD.
Right. It's nice that they have that option, though, because, I mean, I've heard of people doing the jumping straight into the PhD and then ending up with nothing. So, I mean, it's nice at least they give the consolation prize of a master's. You could do worse in life, I guess.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's kind of how it is in my department, too. But the master's, they can certainly give you a master's as a consolation prize, but I had to do a second-year project anyway, and to get a master's degree, it just required a little bit of extra paperwork and formatting my second-year project to look like
pieces.
Okay,
right.
And Christian? I went to my undergrad in Florida, now my PhD, not exactly straight from my undergrad because I took off 2 years to work, but I'm not getting a master's, or not intending to. but I moved in part because my undergraduate institution doesn't have a graduate program, so there wasn't any hope of me getting one there.
If I could be in nice places like Florida and Hawaii, I would stay in grad school forever. I mean, as someone who did my undergrad in Calgary, which is a lovely place, but incredibly cold. Now Ontario, which is lovely, but covered in snow 8 months of the year. Hawaii sounds really, really nice at pretty much any time of year.
Yeah, be honest, Christy. Are you in academia for the weather?
And for the research cruises?
Influenced by the location slightly, to say the least.
So what other things did you guys look for when choosing your supervisors? Because, I mean, from my undergrad thesis through to now my PhD, I've worked with 4 or 5 different supervisors, and I found that, like, I mean, they've all been good researchers in their own right, but I found that I've worked much better with some than others, and it really seems to me to come down to the personality, like the ones that work in a style that is kind of my work style, I seem to be much more productive under than other ones who are equally good researchers and people but have a different work style. What have you guys found? Because I find I found it really tough trying to find a lab that was, you know, that I felt confident was going to be a place where I'd really, you know, do my best.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I agree. Based on my rotations, to me, that's 3 people that I worked with for 13 weeks, and 2 of the 3 I could have easily decided, okay, either one of you would work.
Yeah.
And the last person, it was like, okay, no way, I can't. Work in this lab forever. I mean, there was just stylistic differences in how things were organized or how things were run that it helps to be able to work with them for a little while and then say, okay, this is good, this is bad, this I can handle, this I can't.
Right, no, I can see that would be great. And that's actually the lab I'm working right now. I worked as an RA for a summer last year, and it was great because it was the same thing that I realized, like, okay, this is the type of place I can see myself really enjoying for a few years. And it sort of made the transition into a PhD a lot less frightening for me, at least.
Well, I know for my program, we also required rotations, just like Christie's. And I know two of those people I could have worked with. I think for me, it also came down to, it came down to two things: how you communicate with the advisor and how you communicate with the lab. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's something, sometimes communication is something you really have to work on to make sure that you're able to communicate with your advisor effectively what you want, you know, it, be able to communicate sometimes the little things, you know, like how you write and how they write can be very different. Mm-hmm. You also need to look at the lab and see, well, is it a big lab? Do I like big labs? Is it a small lab? Do I like small labs? And, you know, you also need to say, you know, these people don't need to be your best friends, but they need to be people that you can work with and really be effective with.
Well, and Jason, you were saying before. Well, why don't you ask the question that you were saying before that I thought that was a good point to bring up.
Well, I was just thinking that a good way to frame this might be, you know, what are the things I wish I knew before I was a grad student about grad school.
Anybody want to jump on that?
I wish I knew just how many of those papers you had to read and how much of them you could get away with not reading.
That's a good one.
Read the abstract, look at the figures. Yeah.
I think that's an acquired skill that comes after reading all those papers.
Yeah, it does.
It's an acquired skill that comes with a certain amount of background knowledge.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, I've found that blogging has increased that skill, has sort of sped up the development of that skill for me.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I found blogging has been really useful in terms of getting my mind kind of around certain topics that are sort of tangentially related to my topic, like things that might get asked at a conference or at a thesis defense that aren't really what I do, but somebody could still bring it up if they can't think of a more relevant question. And so I find that now I actually have my thoughts kind of organized on that topic because I actually wrote a post on it. I've found that's been really helpful for me in a few situations.
Well, so this is interesting. I'm interested to know for the others of you how blogging has sort of either shaped your graduate school experience or sort of complemented it, if it has at all.
Well, for me, it's definitely complemented it, I guess you might say. It's definitely, I mean, I agree on all points of making me a better writer in general, of making me a better reader in general. I think blogging has really had a lot to do with how I approach scientific papers now and how I approach understanding anything that I'm trying to understand for whatever reason. And so for me, it's been really, really awesome. It's also been a great way to connect with people,
other
scientists. I mean, I'm on, you know, a conference call with a couple of other graduate students. If I had any questions about something, I mean, I've got people that I know I can call and I know I can talk to and say, oh, hey, you know, I'm wondering about this, and I know you're studying this, so, I mean, it's been better for me than a conferences that I've been to in terms of making connections.
Absolutely. And
also makes going to conferences so much more fun.
Now, do a lot of the people at your conferences know about the blogging? Because at the conferences I go to, there are one or two people who either write blogs or reblogs. In other words, and otherwise, they just kind of like, oh, you're on that Twitter thing, and it's kind of everyone, you know, giggles, and that's the end of it. Like, is it more common in your fields?
I know for me, there are a lot of neuro bloggers out there. So I don't tend to, I mean, obviously, people in my field haven't heard of me. If they've heard of anyone, they've heard of Psycarius. But I do know, I mean, I'll meet up with people. You know, I'll say, hey, Psy's going to Society for Neuroscience this year. Who wants to hang out? And usually, you know, there's people to hang out with, and that's really fun. And also I get to, a lot of people say, oh, come by my poster. I want to show you my work. And that's really cool.
That is cool.
Like an exposure to different fields that I don't normally look at too much, so.
Well, and SFN has been really good about promoting blogs, right?
Yeah, actually, I don't know if it'll continue this year, but last year they had their first neuroblogging initiative, where they actually recruited neuroscience bloggers to specifically blog the conference, and I was one of them. It's still in its formative stages. I'm not sure they really know how they're going to go about doing it, but I think they might try it again this year. I hope so, anyway.
That's cool. There's an obesity conference next year that we're hoping is gonna do that kind of thing. So that sounds like a lot of fun, actually. And Jason, just to get to your question, I find, like, for me, like, when Peter and I started our blog, we were both kind of, like, really disillusioned and bitter about grad school in general. Like, he was halfway through his PhD, and it just wasn't going. It was going well, actually. I mean, he had plenty of publication stuff, but it was just that stage, you know, like, how you get into these kind of slumps where you're just bogged down in the details of, like, reviewer comments, and he was just kind of in the doldrums like that, and I was in the last month or two of my master's and was in that same phase where I just hated everything about my manuscript, and I was just so tired of the revisions. And so for us, it was kind of like an excuse to read stuff that was actually interesting, as opposed to, like, you know, going back and checking the p-values and making these little changes. So I find it's made grad school a whole lot more fun for me personally.
I'd have to agree with that. I know I also kind of started my blog when I was in, like, a grad school slump, where I was like, man, do I really want to do this forever and ever and ever? And then I started reading, you know, papers, because I don't blog about my research. I blog about stuff not related to it. And so reading stuff that was really not related to my stuff got me really excited. It's like, oh, this is really cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is cool, you guys. So, yeah, it definitely really made me much more enthusiastic about my field.
So then, Jason, why did you get into it? I mean, you seem to really like where you are. You seem to like everything about grad school. Whatever made you want to start blogging?
I started blogging for a couple of reasons. One of them was because I realized that they teach you in grad school to write for an academic audience or for a scientific audience, but not for a general audience. And I... You know, in my career, I think translating science for the public is really important. You know, I want to write books, but the only way to learn how to do that, I think, or the best way, is practice.
Also, so I just started. Writing is boring.
So I started blogging. That was one reason. Another reason was, you know, to have a chance to think about other. I sort of started blogging right around the time that I started also getting into research with animals, with animal cognition, and I found it to be a really good way to get a handle on the literature. So, you know, there's sort of a double benefit where I learn a lot really quickly because I'm blogging about it, and I get to do this sort of outreach thing, which I think is really important.
Yeah.
And so where's everybody planning to go next? Like, are you planning to be researchers full-time, or teachers, or knowledge translation people? What's the end goal for you three? Because I have no idea what it is for me, so that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't know. I mean,
actually, my new boss said something really awesome. We had we had someone come in to do an interview the other day, and he said, so, you know, it was a student. He said, what do you want to do when you grow up? And she looks all scared. She's like, I don't know. And he goes, that's okay, me neither. And he's like, big bad PI with tenure.
Right. Yeah.
Nobody knows when I grow up.
What's the plan right now, at least?
Oh, goodness. Get a PhD successfully?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's kind of as far as I'm willing to think. I know the region of the world where I want to end up. And I'm kind of looking at all options that are related to research there, but I have no idea if it'll be academia or whatever.
Well, I know I do really enjoy academia, and I've been having a lot of fun, but I think part of the reason I'm having a lot of fun is because I love being a bench jockey. So
really?
If they end up taking me away from my pipettes, I might get very sad. So we'll have to see what that ends up doing to my career.
And as a postdoc, I take it you probably don't have any teaching responsibilities or anything right now, do you? Is it just like research all the time?
So far, it's research all the time. There will be lots of responsibilities in terms of training people once I'm fully trained, because I only just started.
I was about to say, you must not be in my kind of lab, because I pity the poor postdocs that have to deal with me. Oh, can you tell me how to work this? Oh, this machine seems broken. Oh, I don't know how to do this.
You know, I destroyed $10,000 of equipment one day my first year. My advisor had the amazing look on their face. Oh, my goodness. But I was
pretty...
Oh, busy.
My. Wow, that's... That's awesome.
Well, you know, he said, everyone does it once.
Fair enough.
So that was my once.
That's still pretty nice.
Yeah.
It was an explosion too. It was pretty cool.
Really?
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds cool. Like that sounds terrifying. But we have.
Oh, thank God, it was a room with no windows.
We have no. We have no. Nothing even remotely explosive in our lab, so which is probably a good thing. So I can only imagine what that would be like.
Scary.
Yeah. And so I guess, well, this is kind of a question that I think I know the answer to, but if you could go back and do it again, would you, or would you do anything different? Or are you all, like, no regrets, everything turned out perfectly, couldn't
to
be happy?
Well,
to anyone, yeah.
Well, I guess because I have a PhD now. I don't know. I really liked my research, and I'm still naive enough because I'm just out of my PhD to think it was good research. so, I don't know. I think there are a couple things that I would have changed with regard to, you know, how I handled people, how I communicated with people, but that's just stuff you learn on the way.
Right.
Yeah, I'll say ask me in 5 years and see how I think about what I did and how I did in the beginning.
By the way, how long is the PhD program that you're in?
They say 5 to 7 on average.
Oh, my.
Although, they recently kicked someone out of it who had been there for, like, 12 years, so it's a little more flexible.
Wow, I think we get kicked out after 7. I think the goal is 4 in ours, but you have to a master's. I mean, you end up in school
right.
The same amount of time.
Oh, no, they were going to kick us out after 7 in ours, but... And everyone took almost 7.
Really?
6 to 7. Yeah, pretty common.
My goodness, Jason.
Ours affects 5 to 6 years, and I think the sort of kick out is 10 years. I think actually your credits are only good, like the units that you've earned, either coursework or research units or whatever, are only good for 10 years.
That's smart. That's a good way to do it.
After that, you got to start taking courses again, I guess.
Oh my, that would be horrible.
I don't know, it would be a nice break for research.
Yeah, true. And is there funding in the States? Like here in Canada, we've got like provincial funding bodies, federal funding bodies, some non-governmental organizations. So, I mean, not everyone's funded, but it ends up that you're not living on, you know, on food stamps. Well, we don't have food stamps, but if we did, you wouldn't be living on them.
Funding's what I'm working on right now. I'll tell you about that later.
Okay.
I think the kind of research you do depends a lot. Like, whether or not you need massive funding depends a lot on the kind of research you do. If you're just doing sort of basic, you know, cognitive science kind of thing, you know, that requires 4 computers and a couple response pads, you know, and you can have undergrads participating in the research for course credit, then you don't need major funding.
But then who pays your bills? Like, because I'm not talking about, like, funding the research project, but just, like, paying for your tuition, paying for your rent, that kind of stuff.
Well, in my department, you're guaranteed funding for 5 years.
Oh, okay.
Whether that's through TA or, you know, if you get a fellowship or something. But minimally, they guarantee you to be funded for 5 years.
Okay, and that's, like, enough funding to actually... pay your rent and have groceries and buy the occasional beer kind of thing?
A very poor existence, I would say.
I ate a lot of ramen.
Oh, okay.
I have learned the wonders of rice.
Oh, rice is great, yeah.
Rice is fantastic.
But I don't know if Christy has this, but in biomedical, we're guaranteed funding for the first... I don't know, grad students are usually guaranteed in biomedical funding for the first year or two.
Yep.
And then after that, your advisor pays for you.
Oh, okay.
If your advisor doesn't want to pay for you, they make you apply for funding,
yep.
Which you can get through the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation,
okay.
Things like that. And that will pay a little bit of travel money, a little bit of equipment money, and, of course, your government-mandated stipend, which amounts to roughly peanuts.
Okay,
yeah,
that sounds good.
I'm in the position right now. I mean, I'm transitioning from the guaranteed year to my advisor. And my advisor's going to make sure that I don't starve one way or the other. But if I want to have more money or work more on the project that I want, I have to bring that money in myself.
Right,
so,
okay.
And it's also very good for a grad student to learn how to write say, in an RSA for the National Institutes of Health, it's really good practice for the grant writing stuff, and getting a grant looks really, really good on your resume for postdocs and things like that.
Well, that's what they always say up here, is that, like, you know, the best predictor of future funding is past funding. So once you get a scholarship once, then your, you know, your chance of getting a scholarship or a grant or whatever increases dramatically once you have it a couple times on your resume.
Which is kind of sad when you think about it too hard.
It is. But once you get on that gravy train, then you're good.
I guess that would go into the things I wish I'd known before grad school, is that I'd, like, seen, like, grant writing workshops and grant writing classes as an undergrad, and I wish I'd taken them.
Ooh, that sounds cool. We never had those.
And that's actually a good point, because that was one thing that I only found out because my sister did a master's when I was still an undergrad, and she told me to start applying to grants when I was still an undergrad, because you're put in a separate category. So you're not competing against the masters and PhDs, you're competing against other undergrads, and none of them know to apply. And so the talent pool, so to speak, is not quite so intense. So, that was one thing that I was really glad to know about ahead of time, because it helped a lot for me personally.
Yeah, no, that definitely helps. And a lot of times also there are training grants if you're affiliated with a center. I know in neuroscience, a lot of neuroscience people are affiliated with centers, and there will be training grants that can also be awarded to graduate trainees and will support you for a year while you work on getting your own funding.
Oh, okay, that's nice. Yeah. So I think we've been around 25 minutes. Is there anything else that we've missed that anyone would like to add to this grad school podcast? Feel free, anything at all.
Nothing? Never underestimate the power of free food.
Oh, yes. Or how to
I'm
learn
a postdoc,
how to
and I still
hunt
free food.
Are you guys allowed to eat in the lab? Do you, like, is it okay to actually cook in your labs? Because I know a lot of labs, they really dislike that, and it can be tough to actually eat if you can't microwave in your lab.
Well, according to the health and safety department, no.
I'm not going to answer.
that's very smart, Christy.
We can't have food down in, like, the vivarium, but
sorry, what is that?
The vivarium isn't full of food.
depends on your definition of food.
We can't bring food, obviously, down, like, into the vivarium.
What is that, though? A vivarium?
Where we keep all the animals.
Oh, right, that makes sense.
But, I mean, you know, in my office, you know, which is in a whole other building.
Right, then you can do whatever you want.
I mean, it's probably the case that, you know, in psychology, you know, the thing that we refer to as our lab is a different sort of space than what in biomedical a lab is.
Yeah. Right, that makes sense. Well, even our lab, I mean, my lab is just a room with a bunch of treadmills.
Right, we have a room with some tables and chairs and computers, and a whole bunch of, you know, standardized reading tests.
Right.
Lab.
Right.
Well, I would say that food is highly discouraged on lab benches where pipetting and genetics and PCR and things occur. But
shockingly.
But if your desk is right next to the lab bench, you'd be amazed. People have their coffee and their food just sitting there, right, on the desk, which is part of the lab bench but technically isn't.
Right. So this is one of the many reasons why I got away from basic science stuff and into more exercise stuff, where we can, you know, have our nice little computer and treadmill and not have to worry about what you're accidentally putting in your coffee.
I have to say, I did start washing my hands a lot more when I went into biomedical science.
I started washing my hands more when I started working with live animals.
Yeah,
oh, that
gross.
Too, but live animals aren't half as gross and scary as the many chemicals that you pour on your hands, which could or could not cause cancer. So.
Oh, carcinogen warnings.
Oh, yeah.
Fair enough. And on that lovely advertisement for grad school, why don't we call that a wrap? Thanks a lot for doing this, guys. I hope we can do this again. This was fun. It was great talking to you.
Yep.
All right. Great. Thanks.
All right. Well, have a good night.
All right.
All right. Bye.
Bye.